Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
It's time to change the situation if Tottenham want to change.
It's in the past. It's in the past. And we look forward, buy our football positive. We're wearing Tottenham shirts. We buy the Tottenham white.
And still Ricky Villa. What a fantastic run. He scored.
He's going to have a crack. He is, you know.
Hello, welcome to the Tottenham Way podcast. I'm Dan Kilpatrick. I'm joined by Tom Barkley and Tom Allnutt. It's the day after Tottenham's miserable defeat to Aston Villa in the FA Cup, which left them out of both domestic cup competitions in the space of 4 days, leaves their season really hanging on the Europa League now, and leaves Ange Postecoglou, I think it's fair to say, under a significant degree of pressure. We were all at Villa yesterday, so we're going to get straight into it. We were all also questioning Postecoglou. We all asked questions in the press conference afterwards, which was a really spiky and animated performance, I think it's fair to say, from Postecoglou. He's occasionally tended to come into these post-match press conferences after defeats and just kind of mumble his way through it with very short answers and stare at his shoes throughout. But he was very animated last night. He made the point over and over again that really there's nothing he can do and nothing the players can do at the moment, given the extent of the injuries, the relentlessness of the schedule, and the kind of mental and physical toll that's been taken on the players that aren't injured. He pointed out that Liverpool lost early in the day at Plymouth after making 10 changes to their side from midweek and said that was just one game. And he fired back at his critics, accusing them of being agenda-driven, skewed, and guilty of analysis that was lacking objectivity. I think I've got all those quotes correct. So, I mean, let's get straight into it. You were both there, guys. I mean, is Postecoglou right? Is there any blame that can be put on him and the players, or is this a situation that's kind of spiraled beyond anyone's control?
Well, I think, Dan, his point about the skewed analysis, he was saying, I don't think he was saying it was not fair to criticise him or his team. It's just when you don't factor in the injuries, then it is skewed. And I have to agree with him on that. I know it gets boring for fans to hear, and there's a sort of sense of people becoming numb to the same thing being talked about every week. And it not, you know, the excuse, I suppose, wearing thin, but ultimately they have had such key injuries in such key positions for so long, it cannot help but have an impact. So he is absolutely right to point out, whether people like to hear it or not, that they are a absolutely massive factor. It's whether, for my money, they are enough of, I think excuse is a not quite the right word, but if they're enough of a mitigating factor to be able to overlook the poor form definitely in the league and the going out of the cups on their own. And I do think there's a case to even say that might be the case, but I know a lot of fans probably don't think it's quite enough. And then the other part of it is how much of it is self-inflicted. I don't know if he would suggest that any of it was, whenever he's been asked about the suggestion that his training methods or the way he plays has been a contributing factor to the significant amount of muscle injuries in the team. he has pushed back on it. I mean, literally in the press conference leading up to the Liverpool game, Tom's colleague Hamza at the Times was there, and he was the latest person to ask about that. And his answer, to be fair, I was kind of half waiting for his head to be bitten off, Hamza, going into it, asking that kind of question, because you know how it can sometimes go down with Ange. But he actually gave a really considered and unhostile, if that's a word, answer, but basically pushed back on it massively, saying, effectively in the last 4 months, any of you lot, i.e. the people in the media, could have got involved in his training, which he said before, I think, to Matt Barlow of The Mail, because they basically haven't really been, there's been like no intensity because they've just been playing games, so therefore it's just all been about recovery. He did also admit that they are constantly looking and reviewing and don't want to be in this position again with the amount of injuries. So they're not beyond reproach on that, on that regard. But he sort of pushes back on the suggestion that it's been exacerbated in the last 4 months because the training has been so light. And it seems like by all accounts that is probably correct. It's whether you feel like, I suppose, the way they play and maybe the way they trained in the lead up to all this has also contributed to the amount of injury. So yeah, for me, I completely agree with him. It's just whether it's enough to be able to brush all the bad form under the carpet and whether you feel like he is partially to blame as the head coach and in charge of the whole approach as to where all these injuries have come from.
I mean, I think the issue of whether the injuries are his fault, I kind of want to avoid that because the answer is we don't know. And it will be really hard for anyone to know unless you were working there. I guess these strange cases of Van de Ven and Romero, which are getting stranger by the day, really, and by the passing week, are red flags, I think it's fair to say. But the rest of them, it's very hard.
But I don't know how I get your point that you don't really know. But to sort of basically skirt over that issue at all.
Not that I'm going to skirt over the issue. It's just like, we don't know the answer to that. So it's, I don't.
No, but I think, I get it. But to not even mention it when he is specifically pinning it all on injuries.
Well, you have mentioned it.
Rightly or wrongly, I think is to miss a bit of that debate out. So I wanted to flag it up. But I think you are right to clarify and point out that none of us really know. And the amount of people on social media in particular Twitter, who sort of speak as if they have first-hand experience on this, they don't know. So you're right on that point. But I think not to mention it at all would be a bit remiss.
Yeah, it's more that I don't want to follow up on your point, is what I was trying to say, because it's a bit, we mentioned it and I don't really have any kind of insight as to whether all these problems are kind of primarily down to him or the medical staff or whatever. I mean, one thing I would say is the sense I get, and I think it's been pretty obvious to all of us and most people who've been following Spurs, is that it's been a kind of snowball effect, hasn't it? I mean, for instance, what happened to Richarlison probably doesn't happen if Solanke's also fit, because Richarlison would have been eased back in even more gently. And that's been the case across a number of positions across this whole winter, where you see other players, Johnson and Werner, for example, getting injured because players in their position are already out and they're having to do this schedule. And I think it's happened to Spurs this year. And I think with the schedule, that's going to happen to other clubs in Europe next season. I think it'll happen to someone else next season. Someone, you know, Newcastle will be back in the Champions League or something, and suddenly they'll get another massive injury pile up.
Well, it happened.
It happened to Newcastle last season,
didn't it? I mean, literally.
It being Bournemouth next year, you know, this schedule is so unrelenting now, and there's no circuit breaks, and it's punishing on squads. And that's why Postecoglou, I think, has made the point that he wants bigger squads to be introduced and a rule change, isn't he?
Just before Tom comes in, I mean, one thing that's sort of sprung up on social media again in the last day, which I think is quite relevant, is that the images or the video of Kieran Trippier at Bournemouth last season playing for Newcastle, basically having a go back at the Newcastle fans for criticising the team's form and performances where they kept losing, and him saying, what do you want us to do? How many injuries have we got? And it is often forgotten about, I suppose, what Newcastle went through and to where they're at now, sort of coming out through the other side. So I definitely think your point about the schedule for European teams in European competition is absolutely fair. And a big reason to believe, I suppose, that things can get better.
Well, the only thing is, there are obviously loads of clubs, though, who are playing in Europe. And there aren't that many who've got Spurs' injury problems. You know, you look all the way across Europe, not just the Premier League. I don't see any of the Spanish clubs or Italian clubs going through this and saying, well, look at the schedule, it's unmanageable. Like,
well, they've got one fewer cup competition, to be fair, for a start. And Spurs have gone all, you know, to the semi-final with two legs in the League Cup. It does have a contributing factor just on that one point.
And I think a point that actually Levy, funnily enough, made in the fan forum was that for a lot of these clubs in, and Tom, you'd know better than me and Tom B, but for a lot of these clubs in Europe, the Europa League or the Conference League or Champions League is their priority, whereas that's so rarely the case for a club in the Premier League. They always have to have the Premier League as their first thought, and Europe, perhaps there's a parallel thought on the same level, but certainly not above the Premier League in the kind of pecking order. And it is the most intense league in the world. It's just the toughest competition. So I think that's a kind of false equivalence, personally.
Maybe. I don't know. I feel like I don't see Tottenham and particularly and Premier League clubs being in a specifically more strenuous scenario than other teams across Europe right now. And particularly across, I mean, even if you want to narrow it down to the Premier League, I mean, Liverpool, for example, not having injuries. Arsenal have some, yeah, it's true, but no one has anywhere near the amount that Spurs have had, right? Apart from, I think, Brighton possibly this season, and that's in a slightly different metric. I don't know. I mean, I take your point, but I think I'm slightly more sceptical about it, because to say that, you know, is Ange or not to blame, ultimately the manager is always to blame. Like, he's in charge of the training, he's in charge of the medical staff, he's in charge of the way they play and their recovery. Everything falls on him. And Ange admits that, to be fair. When you put it to him, he says, I'm the one who's to blame for all this. But just as much as if you have a striker who can't score goals, you ultimately blame the manager, because he's the one who picks him. He's the one who motivates him, you know, who probably should have bought a replacement. And in exactly the same way, if a team continually has injuries across a long period of time, again, it should fall on the manager. Like, it doesn't fall on anyone else. Like, you can talk about the medical staff, but this is now over a long period of time. It's not over a month or even 2 months. It's now been back-to-back seasons. Like, it's been two seasons now, you know, where Spurs have basically been derailed by injuries. It was the same last season. They had a good start, got to November, four or five key players injured, and the season, you know, went bust as well. And it's been the same thing this season. So it's not like it's a one-off spell. Like, you've got a good sample of evidence there. You know, in fact, it's much more evidence than I think a lot of managers would get. A lot of chairmen would look at one season like this and say, that's enough. Whereas Ange has had two seasons, basically, where the team has been completely derailed by injuries. And, you know, we're still asking, is it him? Is it just bad luck? I mean, to me, that seems overly generous, I have to say.
What about the point I made about the snowball effect, though? I think you can perhaps, you, let's say, let's work from the point of view that Ange is some way culpable for two intense training sessions, and he also gets a bit of bad luck. Vicario is clearly bad luck. Bentancur ban is unfortunate for him. Moore's illness is a bit of a freak occurrence. So he gets these unlucky breaks, and let's say he's a little bit culpable for, because he pushes them too hard or whatever. Now you've got a situation where you've lost a lot of players, and the strain on the remaining players, I think, is kind of intolerable, and it just gets worse from there. So,
but he has also framed this narrative, Dan, where he only has 10 players that he can use. You know, he's created this thing that we're all now accepting, which is I only have 11 players; they have to play every single week, which is fine. But, you know, who's to say that there are not three or four academy players he could have played more? You know, who's to say that he couldn't have tried other people in different positions? You know, I wonder sometimes when you have a manager and and you get very used to the players that they pick and the system that they use. You get a new manager who comes in and suddenly they try someone else. And you think, why on earth was this guy not playing before? Why was this guy playing in this position before? You know, a different set of eyes changes the whole
thing. Who are the people in the squad that you think that's, you know, if we change manager tomorrow?
Jed Spence is the argument there, isn't it? That he could have played earlier this season. And look at how he's playing now. And I do feel like a lot of this feels like catching hindsight and picking holes, but that is a prime example, which Marcus had been banging the drum for a long, long time, of why wasn't he given an earlier chance. And now you look at how dependent Ange has become on him. My understanding is that Destiny Adogie should be available and is hoping to be involved at Man United at the weekend, but Spencer's played so well. Would you even, you know, if he was fully fit and you were totally sure of him, would you even start him now? That shows how well Spencer's done. But it's through circumstance, not through design from Ange's point of view, isn't it, really, when it comes to Jed Spence? And I know he's almost like a special case because of his alleged attitude problems that have sort of led to where his career's been at Tottenham as opposed to talent. But ultimately, we can only judge it on how well he's played since. And it does feel like Ange took too long to play him. And had he played him earlier, it might have given other players, Udogie prime, you know, first and foremost, more time to rest and therefore might not have got injured. And that's in the snowball effect you're talking about. But, you know, it's so hard to say whether those things would have led one thing to another. We're speculating. But it's likely, had he played him earlier, there would have been more of a chance. Or it would have lessened the risk of injury on Udogie specifically.
I think Spence and Reguilon as well are the two you can point to support Tom's argument there. But I'm kind of, you look at the actual attacking player on the bench, I think it was one player, it was Ajayi. And I know he came on and scored in the Europa League. So actually, you know, he's got some credit in the bank and a lot of supporters are kind of excited about him, calling for him. But I don't know enough about him and I don't think any of us do, to say that it would be better to play him from the start than a tired Son. That's what we're talking about here. Should you have played a tired Son or Demola Ajayi against Villa?
Well, made an interesting point, didn't he, to Ed Ahrens of The Guardian in the press the other day, which probably got overlooked, about how he worried about destroying careers, was the phrase he used, about throwing young players in who aren't ready. And he in his mind, at least, sees a massive difference between bringing on a young player like that towards the end of a Europa League game against a poor, let's be honest, and very defensive Elfsborg team whose resistance had been broken by then, and throwing them in a Premier League match where there is the potential for things to go so badly wrong that the fans absolutely hammer the players. And his worry was that if you're a senior player, you should be able to handle it. But for a young player who's inexperienced, it can, you know, he literally said the risk of destroying a career. And it might sound a bit hyperbolic, but if that's what he's saying, I sort of see what he means. So to his mind, at least, it doesn't feel like that's an option. And let's be honest, I mean, as poorly as Son has played generally all season, I don't think any of us are going, throwing in Demola Ajayi from the off is going to be a massive game like Anfield away or Villa away in the cup was going to be a difference, mate.
Well, that's what Tom's suggesting, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. Is that what you're suggesting, Tom?
It's not just about kind of like, you know, does Ajayi start against Liverpool? It's more nuanced than that. It's you know, are you telling me there are not some players who could have come on for 20 minutes here and there so that Son's not playing 96 minutes every single week? Same with Kulusevski. Like,
I'm with you on that.
Ultimately, it's not really up to us. It's also not up to us to sort of say this academy player is ready or not ready. Like, none of us are claiming to have that kind of knowledge. But it's up to Ange to find solutions. And that is the thing. And the one thing, I think the part of the thing you hear I have a problem with is him saying he has no agency in the season. Him saying that none of us could do anything about this. This is a freak thing. Everyone just needs to forget everything that's happened for the last 6 months and just start from zero from now. Because he's the manager. It's up to him to find solutions. And whether or not that is in the academy, whether it's in finding a different system or a different way of playing, or whether it's in resting players, or whether it's sacking off the Carabao Cup or the FA Cup and saying, we haven't got time for that, we have to play the youngsters and before we have a stronger rested team in the Premier League. Whatever it is, that's fine. It's not up to us. We're not the guys who get paid loads of money to be the manager. But it's up to him to find the solution. And Tottenham being 14th in the league and out of all the cups apart from the Europa League is not a solution. He cannot get to February and say, I couldn't have done anything about this, by the way. Don't blame the players. Don't blame me. This has just been a freak thing. Can you all just forget about it? That it's not an acceptable thing for a manager of Tottenham. Like, it really isn't. And it's not about like who is the 17-year-old who could have played instead of these players. If it's not about personnel, maybe it's about the style. Maybe it's about the training. Or maybe it's about prioritization. But there is a solution here, and Ange hasn't found it.
Yeah, I think you've made some good points there. And I think the thing about bringing players on is another valid one. I mean, one thing, I guess, to follow up on that I have been wondering about, and it's a slightly half-baked thought, but it's kind of, for me, like I'm still not convinced that Ange is the wrong person to build this Spurs project and kind of lead Spurs long-term. I still think he could be a success long-term, because I think when it works, it works really well, and we've kind of seen enough to suggest that it could really work. But I kind of don't think he's the man for right now, this situation. He doesn't strike me as the person for this dire situation, because he, rightly or wrongly, he is not going to significantly rip things up and start again. He would rather, as a kind of 59-year-old Australian immigrant who's had to claw his way to the very top of the game over a number of years, he would rather go down kind of on his own terms than compromise, I think, and that's fine. But he doesn't strike me as the kind of person Spurs need in this dire crisis of a situation where, yeah, the squad is kind of stretched to bits, and the players that are fit are mentally and physically exhausted. But I still kind of wonder whether, if everything was kind of sunshine and rainbows, he would actually still be, you know, a great pick for them. Does that kind of make sense? I think it sort of speaks to what you're saying in a way, Tom.
I see what you mean. It's funny, that argument about how he's had this long-winded and very unorthodox and difficult journey to Tottenham, and how, as a result, and he said it himself essentially, that he doesn't want to change. It's funny when you frame it like that, you sort of get it. But then also, like, the other way is like, look, you've worked so hard to get this massive opportunity which you've never had before. Why wouldn't you look at every different road to trying to basically stay in that position? It doesn't mean throwing away all your principles, but, you know, if it's not working, maybe, I don't know. And to be fair, in the most recent couple of games, he has tried to change it. It hasn't worked, but he has tried to change it, which is why I found, particularly after the Liverpool game, you know, Jamie Redknapp's criticism of how he never changes, kind of baffling, because anyone who watched that game at Liverpool, it felt like he tried to defend his way to a result. It clearly didn't work, but to have a go at him for not changing in that game, and after that game, seemed like a strange bit of analysis, really. I think Tom makes some really good points, but kind of back to what Andrew's saying about the whole the brightness of the sun analogy that he used, where he said that you know, you can go outside and it's really bright, you think, oh, what is it? It's not the sun, but then you realise it is the sun. That's the reason. And essentially, no matter what he'd done, any other little tweaks he could have made, and he definitely could have done a few things which might have worked better. Ultimately, this absolutely crippling injury crisis that's gone on for so long to absolutely key players would have decimated anyone's season. It's just whether it could have been slightly less bad if he'd done a bit of changing here and there, and maybe they wouldn't have dropped quite so far down the league. But let's be honest, any manager in that situation, it would have affected results. And that's the crux of it, isn't it?
Yeah, but over two seasons.
Yeah. Yeah, and I see that, and that's what everyone points to, and they point to Crystal Palace when I think Van de Ven and Romero are playing. Arsenal's a bit different because it's a tough game, but Ipswich, I think Romero's playing. I mean, there are various games where they've had, you know, key players in key positions playing, and they've still lost, and almost like that's a different argument to a certain extent, and that does feel like really fair criticism. And actually, once he gets his player back, if it ever actually happens, that's when it feels like the heat's really on, because there's no excuse, you know, as legitimate as it is, as it has been the last few months, that'll be done with. And that's where it really feels like he will be under pressure if he can't deliver at that point. But I think the jury is out on that front, whether he is basically the man when he's got everything at his disposal going forward. Dan still thinks he is. I think a lot of people are not quite sure on that, but as regards to his argument for the form recently and his points he made last night, I still think ultimately he is correct in what he's saying.
Well, I don't necessarily think he's the messiah going forward, but I think he deserves to be judged when he's got a fuller squad. And I can see, as I said, I can see a scenario where with a full squad, with a easier schedule, let's say Spurs aren't in Europe next year, they you know, have a season like, say, Newcastle are having now. I don't think that's beyond the realms of possibility. And Newcastle and Spurs are an interesting kind of case study because they've kind of had the reverse season, haven't they? Like, it feels like this, not quite to this extent, but this is what Newcastle were going through last year.
I mean, I think last, it's worth saying on the presser itself, it was quite, and I don't want this to sound like it was kind of premeditated or anything, but I think it was a very smart thing to do for Postecoglou to launch a really passionate defence of the players, you know, because you're right that whenever anyone asked a question, I mean, there was four questioners in the presser and me, you and Tom were three of the four. And we all sort of came at it from a slightly different angle, but on a similar theme, really. And every time it was kind of put on him, you know, he said, oh, it's not about me. You know, it's, you know, if you want to get me fired, then fine, go for it, mate, sort of thing. But it's about the players. But I think he knows that in defending the players, the extension is that he's also defending his own record. But I think more than that, you know, he probably knows right now he really needs the players, doesn't he? You know, he needs them more than ever, basically. He needs them to stick with him, because if this was Conte, then I think he would have let go of them by now. You know, we would have had, after the Liverpool game in midweek, we would have had him saying they're not up for the big games, they're not ready for the big titles, give me more experience. And Ange hasn't done that, like, all the way through, even when the heat was really on the players in the middle of the week. You know, he had all the, you know, usual pundits saying, now they're, you know, this is Tottenham, et cetera, et cetera. You know, he really has stuck up for them all the way through. And I think there's more to that than just kind of loyalty. I think he knows that he needs them. And I'm wondering, I mean, in the performances you've seen this week, Dan, like, do you still think that the players are playing for him? Because I think that's what we've said, haven't we, over the last few weeks and months, that yes, the team is kind of on its knees, but you can still see the team playing kind of his style of football. I guess my question to him in the press conference was like, you know, are you concerned that this doesn't look like a Postecoglou team at the moment? And I wonder if there's everyone always talks about, are the players, you know, the players as a collective, but I always think that there are 15, 20 players involved in this. And I suspect there are at least three or four who aren't with him anymore. And it's just about, are the core with him? Are the main ones with him? And what do you think?
Before I answer that, I want to pick up on the Conte point, because I actually made the point in my piece today. I did a sort of colour piece on where Postecoglou is and took in a lot of his press conference, that I thought there was a really interesting contrast with Conte's last press conference, where I felt Conte eviscerating the players at Southampton was kind of self-preservation, at least in part. And he chose to deflect blame from himself by throwing the players under the bus, whereas Postecoglou's kind of sought to deflect blame from himself and seek self-preservation by praising them to high heaven. So they're both going for the same thing, but with the complete opposite approach. But I mean, one of them deciding, I don't need these guys anymore, because obviously he decided he was done with the club, but one of them seeking to kind of deflect the blame by shifting it somewhere else, and the other one seeking to kind of deflect the blame by really praising the squad. I thought that was a really interesting contrast there.
That's a good point.
But yeah, do I think the players are still playing for him? I mean, that is a really tough question. I mean, what has kind of, I think, alarmed me about this week, and particularly Liverpool — I didn't do the reaction pod with you guys — it wasn't the result. I think, you know, a 4-0 win, if Spurs had gone for it as they did in the 6-3, would have been fine in the circumstances with the squad as it was. It was just the lack of fight and conviction and belief. And I'm not sure how much of that was about Postecoglou or how much it was just about the occasion and these players not being ready for it and kind of being gutted by the schedule and the injuries and all the rest of it. But that did kind of set alarm bells ringing, I think, just how meek they were, losing every 50-50, you know, never once looking like they thought they could really win that game at Anfield.
And they were like that, though, in the first half an hour against Villa, I thought. Like,
yeah, I was about to say.
We might be having a different discussion right now if Villa had scored three goals in that first half an hour, which they could easily have done, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right. And I've written this, but, you know, it did feel to me at times in the Villa game, in the first half like it was end of days. Like, it had that feel of a team that had just completely lost discipline and lost shape and lost structure. And Villa were just kind of walking through the midfield. And actually, it was Kinski who kept the scoreline respectable and sort of spared it being a total embarrassment, despite being at fault for the goal after 57 seconds. So, yeah, I mean, I think if you wanted to kind of make the case that the players have thrown in the towel, you could. I don't think they have, or they all have, given that they scored in stoppage time and actually that it did stabilise in the second half. I mean, it felt to me, to be honest, at 1-0, like Villa were much more likely to get the second goal, but there was still a chance Spurs got the next goal in that game. And that from there, it could have been a much more interesting contest. I think Villa obviously didn't have any natural centre-halves on the pitch either. Spurs had one. It could have been a game from there. Had Son, say, taken that chance, or had Spurs put another one away. So, yeah, look, I'll defer kind of judgment, and this is the part of the problem, really, is we've been deferring judgment all winter. But I will defer judgment for United when they've had a week off. I think it's only fair to given that Postecoglou is going to be in charge of that one, we're told, to kind of see how they respond after, I think, 3 days off this week. They're not going to be in training Monday, Tuesday or Thursday. They've got a few players back. I think Vicario and Udogie are definitely going to be available. I think Madison and Johnson are pushing as well. So he will have some options. But I was alarmed by some of the stuff I saw last night. I mean, one area of the team that hasn't been really badly impacted, at least not until the last few weeks, has been the midfield. And actually, Bentancur's not played a lot because of his ban and his two concussions. And he was just all over the place in the first half an hour, 40 minutes last night. Oh.
Do you know how many passes do you think Bentancur made in the first 25 minutes?
Three,
yeah.
Is it right? Am I right? Okay. Three. I didn't know that.
I mean, to be fair, Bergvall made four.
Really?
Between the two of them, you had two passing midfielders made three and four passes in the first, best part of half an hour.
I think to get back to the sort of Postecoglou's argument, I think one thing that isn't helping his case for the defence is that he has seemed to get the team wrong in the last two games. And again, as Tom B, who, by the way, has just run off to do some parenting, so we've just lost him.
Yeah, we haven't cancelled Tom.
We haven't just sidelined him. I think, as Tom B said, there is an element of hindsight, but you actually look at the setups against Liverpool and the setup against Villa, and I think you can easily make the case that they were both kind of wrong. I mean, so I thought Spurs got more of a foothold when Bissouma came on last night at Villa, and I thought Son and Tell both looked happier when they swapped positions. And one thing I think you can criticise Postecoglou for, and should, is I feel like we've been having I've certainly been having this conversation with my editor, who's a Spurs fan, for about 18 months about just stop playing Son through the middle. It doesn't work. And it's still seemingly happening. So I was kind of baffled by that. And I'm not sure Tell necessarily looks ready for the task at hand. It's a big ask to get him to lead the line in the Premier League at kind of 19 after a few days training. But I think that goal would show that he's got that kind of instinct. He's got that kind of fox in the box instinct that might make him a pretty useful centre forward. So, I mean, I thought he could have got the selections given the limited resources at his disposal better in both games.
The midfield is also a real good example of that, isn't it? Because he has had options in there, okay, off and on. People have come and gone a little bit, but actually through this last couple of months, he has generally had, four or five options in there between Kulusevski, Saar, Bissouma, Bentancur and Bergvall. And that's not even, that's even discounting Gray as well. But do we know who he really thinks is his best midfield? Like, do we know what he'd play in a Europa League final right now? I mean, I don't have any idea. I don't think he does either. And it strikes me as one of those things when a manager is under pressure and hasn't had the team playing well for a while, where they just, it feels like they're kind of grasping at straws, you know? I mean, which one does he, I mean, does he trust any of them? I don't think he does. Like, I don't think he trusts Bissouma at all. Every time he plays him, he takes him off. Every time he's on the bench, he sort of brings him on. Same for Bentancur, you know, he's, I mean, I would like to see the stats of how many times these guys have completed 90 minutes, you know, because they're just, they never seem to deliver when he trusts him. And when he puts someone else in, they don't either. So he brings them back. I mean, Bergvall has probably been the most consistent overall, but equally, I thought he was pretty poor last night. Maybe one of his worst games, I think, I've seen so far. And maybe that's down to fatigue, fine. But it wasn't a good game from him. Saar, similarly, has had, you know, two or three really poor games in recent weeks when he was, for a while, a real consistent performer. So you've got guys here, you know, who the manager isn't getting the best out of at the moment. And you know, I think me and Tom were pretty scathing, really, of Bentancur and Bissouma after the Liverpool game. And to some extent, I just wonder if they're ever going to be at the level. But equally, you know, if you turn it around, you say, well, the coach isn't making them play better, really. I mean, I don't think we've seen Bentancur at his best really under Postecoglou. We saw it very briefly from Bissouma early on last season, but he hasn't found the right combination in there, and it's killing Tottenham. It really is, because that is where teams hurting them. You know, you look at Villa last night, just basically picking the ball up in the center circle and running it to the edge of Tottenham's penalty area, basically over and over again for basically the whole of the first half, and having pop shots. It was like shooting practice. And I mean, until he finds that correct balance, you know, I think nothing else really works for him, does it? But it will be interesting. I mean, going into the United game, obviously, if he has Maddison back, you know, suddenly we're thinking of Maddison as someone that Postecoglou really needs, when, again, not someone he trusted in the first half of the season. Really, really wasn't playing in the big games. But it does feel like that would give them a lift. And Udogie as well, and Vicario. I mean, I think Kinski, we'd all agree, has, you know, I think, shown a lot of promise in this period. Looks to me like a really good option as a number two, good young keeper who can get better and better. Equally, I think in the last two or three weeks, he's looked like someone who probably isn't quite ready. You know, maybe it was the kind of the adrenaline pumping in the first few games and he did really well. And just recently, he's just kind of shown a few weaknesses. And I think having Vicario about will also be a big boost. So, you know, do we think that these next two games, United, Ipswich, assuming they have three or four players back for each of them, because maybe the week after they get Solanke back, possibly, you know, do we think they are now kind of really big games for his future, or do we think the club will stick it out until the end?
Big question. A few weeks ago, when Spurs were in freefall before the Brentford win, I think I was thinking the board's calculation here has to be either A, he gets the cup games, he deserves the cup games, or B, he deserves to be judged when the players are fit. So we're through the cup games now. Spurs have lost both of them, and we don't think Postecoglou is going to be sacked. You know, we're told he'll be in charge for Manchester United. So I think the calculation has to have been B. And from what I'm told, you know, the board see it Postecoglou's way, that they, you know, they believe the injuries are the reason for the poor results. So he will get a chance to be judged when he's got players back. But I think, if, as you say, you know, by the Ipswich game, the majority of these players are back, and, you know, it might just be the two centre halves, the slow burners, as we call them, which is, I'm sure we could do a whole podcast on their situations alone. If it's just them and everyone else is kind of back, then I think there's, you know, that's more than enough to kind of fully judge Postecoglou on. And, you know, we know that United are kind of the other crisis club in the Premier League. It's not quite another El Sacico yet, but, you know, it's a big game for both managers, I think. And, you know, they both kind of need results. And I think Ange even more so than Amorim. And then it's, you know, Ipswich at home, you know, one of the, you know, weakest sides in terms of quality, technical quality in the Premier League. Spurs lost that away, that, you know, they can't be letting Ipswich do the double over them. So, yeah, I mean, I think if he loses both the games, you know, I've really struggled to see how the Spurs are still kind of supporting
it. But then the Europa League will be just around the corner. And they'll play Ipswich and United, and then it will be, a couple of weeks until the Europa League last 16. And you can imagine, I'm already thinking, there'll be another checkpoint where they'll think, we'll just give them the last 16 and see how we get on in the Europa League.
Given the shortage of replacements, and given how much Daniel Levy must be loathing the thought of having to put Mason in charge, or indeed Matt Wells this time, for another interim spell, because those two spells have not been good for him or the club. You know, I guess there is a case just to give Postecoglou to the end of the season, come what may. But I think, you know, one thing that we haven't mentioned yet is the sort of gallows humour from the away end at Villa, and the brief kind of flickers of anger at the team that we saw. I mean, obviously, we know they're venting at Levy, the fans, at the moment. But when I think Thielmann sort of strolled to the edge of the box and got a shot away, there were loud boos from the away end. And, you know, if the fans turn on the team and the players, and I guess by extension, they're turning on Postecoglou in that situation, then that gives the board a reason to get rid of him. And that makes it much harder, I think, for him to stay on. You know, while the fans are against the chairman but behind the players, I think Postecoglou is in a stronger position. But that, I don't necessarily think that would still be the case if Spurs lost to Ipswich away and United at home. So,
although, I mean, if they get rid of him and they leave Mason in charge, it feels like there's no screen there, is there, in terms of backlash against Levy and the board. I feel like once you take Ange out, once you take that whole debate and the discussion and noise out, all of the scrutiny then goes on Levy and how it's been four managers in whatever it's been, you know, 3 years. And don't you think? I mean, I almost think it leaves them even more vulnerable.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think it would be a disaster as well, and I think the players would chuck in the towel as well, because you know they've been through the mill, and I guess it comes back to your question just now. I do think a lot of them, you know, we heard from Kulusevski a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? And it was a couple of weeks ago, but he sounded very authentically and passionately kind of behind Postecoglou, and he's a dressing room leader, as we know, and I think there will be others who feel that way. And I think if the club kind of gets rid of him and gives an interim coach, you know, the chance to work with a full squad that Postecoglou we've kind of been denied for whatever reasons throughout this winter, I think it would not end particularly well. The season would quite possibly go from very, very bad to even worse.
The only thing I wonder is if, you know, we're always assuming that the interim would be a Ryan Mason job, but I just wonder if they might, you know, find something else.
You're going to start suggesting Hoddle, like Mark. Bring back Benitez.
I really enjoyed that section of podcast.
No, I think he, in many ways, Marcus is living in the early 2000s, but it's a safe space for him. So he's happy.
I think Redknapp was in there as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, Redknapp was.
But I mean, you know, in all seriousness, whatever the kind of, I was going to say the sort of modern version of those guys, but actually not. I mean, someone who the club think could do a job, you know, but is maybe a sort of slightly a short-term appointment, you know, someone who happens to be free in Europe who might kind of want the opportunity to manage in the Premier League.
This sounds very Ralph Rangnicky, I have to say. What? This sounds very Ralph Rangnicky. Someone from Europe who wants the opportunity to manage in the Premier League. I know you're going.
They could be in the Europa League and they might think who has good experience of European competition, who can maybe take us, you know, a long way in this particular tournament, you know, and they Wandy Ramos, exactly. You know, I don't think we should discount the idea that they might be able to find someone else apart from Mason to do it for 4 months. I think it'd be a very difficult ask, because most, you know, distinguished coaches, anyone who Spurs would be interested in would probably want a, you know, 2-3 year contract. So it's a very difficult thing. I think we've said that before, and that is probably the reason that Ange is still in the job, to be honest. But I wouldn't rule it out completely.
Yeah. Okay. We've rambled on a bit, but some interesting thoughts there. I mean, yeah, a very big game coming up against United, and we hope, we expect that Spurs will have some players back for that one. So any final thoughts, Tom, on Ange, on Tottenham, on Villa, or on anything?
No, I mean, I still think if he's the big picture, if you want to look at it optimistically, there is always, you know, the fact that, okay, they could have 3 or 4 players back this week. They could have 2 or 3 more back the week after. United are there for the taking as much as anyone is at the moment. And if they could just turn a little corner, then Spurs could have a squad that, you know, has some freshness, that actually hasn't really played that many games this season. They have a very singular focus where they can go into the Europa League, you know, feeling like, okay, this is our be all and end all, which, you know, has, I don't think, ever been the case for Spurs in the Europa League over the last decade. You know, I think it's a narrow path to making anything of this season from here, but it is there. It is still there. But it needs to start, you know, this weekend against United, that's for sure. And you know, it's, I don't know, it feels like it could go either way, doesn't it? I feel like, you know, you could see Ange with his players back and then they still don't deliver for him. And I think that would be very difficult to justify from the club's point of view and from his point of view as well. But hopefully for us, it's there's a gear change somewhere, because it's felt like sort of Groundhog Day, hasn't it, for the last few weeks?
Yeah, it's been pretty bleak. And won't anyone think of the journalists? I mean, thank God we get a free midweek for once. okay, well, we've lost Tom B, but thank you, Tim, for his earlier contributions. Thank you, Tom, and thank you for listening. We might be back before United if we can bring ourselves to get up the sofa.
Get Marcus in for some...
We need to hear from Marcus, don't we? Actually, do we? I don't think we do. We'll keep you posted. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.